Hi.
Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. The massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut has sparked a fierce national conversation about gun control, but that's not all. Stories about shooter Adam Lanza's mental health struggles on the heels of other shootings where the perpetrator had mental health problems in Colorado, Arizona, and at Virginia Tech have resulted in initiatives to increase access to mental health care and to prevent people with mental illnesses from buying guns. These conversations have put some mental health advocates on edge. Many welcome the national attention to providing better services, but are highly concerned about linking mental illness to violence and mass killings. We have three experts today on Radio Times who will weigh in on this issue. Joseph Rogers is here in the studio. He is Chief Advocacy Officer of the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Thank you so much, Joe, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We have Professor Mark Salzer. He is chair of the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple University. Thank you for being here.
Of course, Mike.
And on the phone is Brian Stetton. He is the policy director for the Treatment Advocacy Center and one of the authors of New York's assisted outpatient treatment law called Kendra's Law. Brian, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure to be with you, Mike.
And of course, if you want to weigh in on the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. Joe, what was your gut reaction in December when the conversation after the Newtown shootings turned to mental illness, to those issues? What were you thinking?
I was very concerned. I was, horrified in a way, because the push to link mental illness to violence only creates problems for people with mental illness, only scares people away from getting the services and help that they need, creates stigma, creates discrimination. So I'm very concerned that we the statistics, the studies show that you can't really do it. You cannot link the fact that somebody has a diagnosis of mental illness and potential for violence. There's no studies, no science that shows that.
So, Mark, let me turn to you. Joe just mentioned stigma, which has been at the heart of your professional efforts when it comes to people with mental illness. So what was going through your mind?
Yeah, I had the exact same reaction to it. I knew what was coming next. Once we heard about these shootings, I was just waiting to hear about mental health issues. I was waiting to hear about Colorado, Arizona, Virginia Tech, and the assumption in the population and some advocates that there was a connection between mental health and the shootings. And I knew what the impact would be on people with mental health issues. I knew how demoralizing it would be. I knew that people would be experiencing guilt by association. In fact, one of our colleagues, Pat Deegan, put together a wonderful YouTube video called Recovery and Nonviolence, where she describes her reaction to it and how horrified she was, how upset she was by what was coming from the media and from policymakers, and that has happened.
And Brian, what about you? What were you thinking?
Well, certainly my immediate reaction when we hear about any of these incidents, and there have obviously been many of them lately, is to immediately wonder, was this individual one of ours, as we say, someone with severe mental illness that was untreated, and were there opportunities to get that person treatment before this took place that were not taken advantage of?
And Brian, describe your organization, the Treatment Advocacy Center. What is your mission? What is your goal?
Sure. Our mission is to remove legal barriers to the treatment of severe mental illness. Our work is founded on the understanding that there are individuals with severe mental illness in the community who, by no fault of their own, not because they are bad people, but as a consequence of their illness, do not seek treatment because they do not understand that they are sick. And while, you know, your other guests and I can agree on the fact that there are huge problems in the mental health field today with lack of availability of resources for everybody, an additional problem that contributes to this is the fact that there are some folks who, even if you make great services available, they don't seek them out and they refuse them and don't take part in them because they don't believe they have an illness. And so we want that dealing with that part of the issue to be part of the conversation and part of the solution. And that's what our work is about, having laws in the states reflect the fact that there is often a need to intervene on behalf of someone who does not believe they're sick and does not think they need treatment.
So where, in your opinion, is there an intersection between mental illness and public safety? Is there a threat? And
well,
what is that threat?
Sure. Let me first say that the primary reason we want people to get treatment is because we want them to get well. This is essentially motivated, most importantly motivated, by a desire to help folks who are in desperate need and don't understand that they are. But undoubtedly, a secondary benefit of dealing with these problems through more enlightened approaches and policies and laws is going to be an enhancement of public safety. And, you know, when Joe and Mark speak about the fact that there's no link between mental illness and violence, I actually think we're contributing to the problem by not acknowledging that there are certain types of mental illness under certain circumstances that, in fact, are associated with violence. It is true as a blanket statement to say that people with mental illness are no more likely to commit violence than other people. As a blanket statement, the problem is that when you drill down, there's more to the picture than is presented when you make that statement.
All right, let me give Joe Rogers a chance to react. You were shaking your head, Joe.
Well, again, I think that the Treatment Advocacy Center has worked very hard to link people with mental health issues to violence, and there's almost a bumper sticker out there: "Support mental illness, or I'll kill you," and that's not going to help. Most people who commit violent acts in this country, the vast majority of violent acts, there's no real link between. Do they have emotional problems? Are they emotionally troubled? Probably. Nobody does the horrible things that get done without being troubled. But if you look at the major diagnoses of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and serious depression, the things that get people labeled mentally ill, the link is that we don't see violence. There is some evidence that if people are abusing alcohol and drugs in general, whether you have a mental health diagnosis or not, there's a greater chance that you're going to get involved, possibly, in doing something violent. So again, this linking of mental health issues to violence so that we can get funds for services, to me, in the long run, creates stigma, drives people away, they don't go for the help they need, and they get into trouble.
But
may I reply to that?
Okay, 1 second. Let me give Mark a chance real quick, and then I have a quick follow-up. Mark, go ahead.
Well, I actually wanted to say that I do think there is a link between mental illness and violence, but the link isn't exactly what some people are talking about. It's not people with mental health issues committing violent acts. It's the fact that, and what I think the narrative should be and what people should understand, is that people with mental illnesses experience more violence than the general population. Approximately 70% of people with serious mental illnesses have been traumatized, have PTSD, have experienced severe trauma in their lives, physical violence, emotional violence, sexual violence in their lives. So they're more likely to be victims of criminal acts, and they're much more likely to engage in self-harm. Suicide is incredibly high, up to 10 times the general population for people with serious mental illnesses. This is the public health concern that we should have.
We did have, I just pulled that statistic, 38,364 suicide deaths just last year.
And this is the major concern that we should have, linking violence and mental health, but it's not that these are evil perpetrators. The NRA has switched from, criminals, thugs, use guns to kill people. It's not guns who kill, it's people, bad people. Now they just replace it with people with mental illnesses. That's the wrong message. That's inaccurate. We should be focusing on the harm that people experience with mental health issues, and that's where we should really be targeting our time and effort and funds.
Right, but Brian, you are not, your organization is not in the business of perpetuating that message, correct?
No, we're not in the business of sticking our heads in the sand or sugarcoating the realities here. I think we need a bit of a reality check on some of the things that have been said. It is true, as I said, that folks with mental illness in general are not more violent than the general population. However, when you look at certain mental illnesses, because let's remember that people with mental illness is a pretty vast category, when you look specifically at people with the most severe mental illness, like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and then drill down within that group to folks who are not receiving treatment, it is a very different story. One of the largest studies that has been done on this, the National Institute of Mental Health's Epidemiologic Catchment Area Study, followed nearly 18,000 people. They found that the lifetime prevalence of violence among people with serious mental illness, that is, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and the like, was 16%, compared with 7% among people without any mental disorder. Now, that may not seem huge, but when you also factor into that, that most of those people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder are receiving treatment, and people who receive treatment, even for those severe disorders, are not more violent than other folks. We have lots of studies to tell us that. What we gain from that, what we learn, is that people who are not receiving treatment for these severe mental illnesses are absolutely a disproportionate risk of committing violence. And no, it is not going to be the majority of the violent crime, or even more than, you know, 4 or 5% of the total violent crime that's taking place in society. Nobody's suggesting you can deal with this issue as some kind of a comprehensive crime reduction strategy. But this is one segment of the crime problem that can be dealt with by acknowledging that if we can just get treatment to people who are resisting it, we can prevent some of these acts. And yes, as Mark says, it's absolutely
As somebody who has a diagnosis, who has a diagnosis of severe mental illness, I have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. I've never committed a violent act in my life. I know thousands and thousands of people with that diagnosis and other diagnoses of schizophrenia never committed a violent act in their life. Your constant effort to link those serious illnesses with violence is doing me personal harm. The reality is that we can help people. There is help available. What we can do is outreach. We have a program called Access here in Philadelphia. We work with some of the most treatment-resistant, so-called treatment-resistant people, homeless people that lived on the street sometimes as many as 10 years. I've been on this show to talk about it. And we've been extremely successful by having a voluntary program of outreach and engagement in getting those people help. When you start forcing people, when you start coercing people, they run away from you. They don't get help.
And Joe, just because you know this issue better than probably many of our listeners, Brian, we have about a minute before we have to go to break. What kind of legislation, in your opinion, makes sense then? What should be in place?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the commitment standards, what it takes to get somebody hospital care who does not understand their own need for it, has to be compassionate enough and open enough to recognize that we can't base it only on those who we believe are at immediate risk of committing a violent act. Somebody who is unable to meet their basic survival needs, somebody who is doing damage, potentially irreversible damage to their brain that they don't understand, that they have an opportunity to address, those are folks who should be eligible for inpatient commitment, even if we can't prove that they're going to commit a violent act imminently. So that's part of it. The other piece of it is to make assisted outpatient treatment available. That is court-ordered care on an outpatient basis for folks who are able to survive safely in the community but need some assistance in complying with their outpatient treatment.
All right, and Brian, with that, we have to get to break, and then I'm going to have Mark react to those kinds of legislative initiatives. That's Brian Stedden from the Treatment Advocacy Center, also joined by Joe Rogers and Mark Salzer from Temple University. We're talking about mental health and what kind of treatments should and are available out there. That's here on Radio Times. Give us a call if you want to join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Big Blue Marble Bookstore, an independent, locally owned bookstore in the heart of Mount Airy Village, carrying smart, fun books for all ages. For details on author events, book clubs, story times, and more, bigbluemarblebooks.com.
Teachers can learn to guide students through the basic skills they'll need to create great documentaries. Sign up now for Teacher Documentary Production, a two-session course at WHYY's Hamilton Public Media Commons, Saturday, February 16th and 23rd. Teachers will record and edit media and receive our complete documentary workshop curriculum for students grades 6 through 12. 10 hours of PA Act 48 credit and documentation for New Jersey and Delaware. Register at whyy.org/teachers.
I'm Jesse Thorne. How many times have you seen The Big Lebowski? If it's zero, sorry, bear with me. 3 times? 5 times? 10 times? You're in good company. Even Jeff Bridges, the dude himself, loves to watch it.
It'll come on the TV, and I say, I'm just going to watch it till Totoro licks the ball, and then I'm hooked, and it's like popcorn. I can't stop.
Jeff Bridges and Zen Master Bernie Glassman, this week on Bullseye from PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. The Oriental Rug Room at 10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY. Their annual rug event starts today, featuring the Fair Trade Bunyad Rug Collection of over 1,500 hand-knotted rugs. Online at rugs.10,000villages.com.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about mental health care and how and if it intersects with public safety concerns, and also talking about access to care. Our guests are Mark Zalzer from Temple University, Joe Rogers from the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania, and on the phone is joining us Brian Stetton from the Treatment Advocacy Center. And Brian, I had to cut you off because of our break. So describe again, what is assisted outpatient treatment? And assisted here means forced, if we're honest.
Well, it doesn't mean forced medication. Let's be clear about that. We're not talking about holding somebody down and injecting them against their will. That's something that can only take place in a hospital environment and only after it's been proven that the person has no capacity to make their own treatment decisions. But we are talking about a court order that directs a person to comply with their treatment plan as a condition of remaining in the community. And, you know, Joe talks about programs that work. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a more studied and analyzed program that works than this. This is something that has been used to tremendous effect in New York State, where it has been studied multiple times and been found not only to improve treatment outcomes for the folks in these programs who, I should say, in order to qualify for this, had had a history of not adhering to their treatment on an outpatient basis and having all kinds of personal disaster ensue as a result. That's the reason they are even eligible to be part of it. They do phenomenally better any way you measure it when you put folks into this kind of program. And sometimes after a while, they do gain some insight into how much treatment is helping them, and you don't have to keep them under these court orders for years and years. It really is a very case-by-case situation as far as, you know, how long you need to keep people in this kind of treatment. But we're talking about something that is amazingly effective. And a side benefit of it is that it has been shown to have an effect on people's likelihood to commit violent crimes.
All right, let me have Mark Zalzer react now.
Well, again, I'll echo the concerns that Joseph's expressed about linking mental illness and violent crimes. That doesn't do anybody any good. It doesn't do people with mental health issues any good. It promotes stigma. It promotes violence towards people with mental illnesses. It does not help matters. I actually think it's quite cynical to make this connection between mental illnesses and violence. I'll also I'll say that the research is less positive than it's being presented as. The randomized controlled studies that have actually been conducted on involuntary outpatient commitment or assisted outpatient treatment have not shown greater benefits for people with mental illnesses who have been assigned to it. There are subgroups that might benefit from this, but there are all sorts of research issues that undermine the validity of that. So most people are concluding that the data, the studies to date, are equivocal. We don't know if it's better or not.
But
let me say that the thing that I would love to see advocates for involuntary outpatient commitment really promote is self-determination at the same time. So go ahead and promote AOT, assisted outpatient commitment, or involuntary outpatient commitment. But at the same time, I'd love to see these individuals also promote greater efforts of self-determination for people. I'd like to see them promote agencies having 50% of board members be individuals with serious mental illnesses to help direct what agencies do. I'd love to see them promote shared decision-making and self-directed care model. These are models where people with mental illnesses have greater say in the treatment of that they're receiving. I'd love to see them promoting greater consumer involvement, patient involvement in policy decisions, rather than policy decisions being made by people like me, a psychologist or psychiatrist or other people. We need to hear from people like Joseph and also other people about their experiences and how this would impact their lives. So I would love to see, and I suspect that we hopefully have agreement, that these self-determination types of initiatives would also be positive for promoting services and good outcomes for people with mental illnesses.
And Joe, Sorry, did you have a direct comment on that?
Yeah, I think what we're looking, I think what we all have agreement on is that people need to get help. And in Pennsylvania here and in New Jersey, we've actually seen a cut in our budgets. We've seen a cut in their ability here in Philadelphia to do outreach, which we had a very aggressive outreach program where we could go out and meet people on the street when they're look at their situation, help them get medication if they needed medication, help them get medical care. That program's been cut because of the cuts in the budget. So I think what we're facing is not an expansion of the ability to help people. We're seeing it rolled back. So, yes, serious people with serious and persistent illnesses are not getting the supports they need. But more force and coercion is not the answer. The more treatment teams, more mobility of treatment teams, more outreach teams to the homeless, outreach teams to where people can go into people's homes and work with people, work with family members, educate family members so that we can get people the help they need.
Let me get one of our callers to weigh in who looks like is a family member of somebody with a mental illness. We have Maria joining us from Ardmore. Hi, Maria. You are on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to say I have had very bad experience, you know, in when my son was sick and he went to crisis and, you know, crisis to try to get help, and they release him. They say, no, he's not sick enough. So, and then when he went back again and they put him in. While he was in the hospital, I saw a girl there who was so mentally ill sick, but she refused to take her medication. And they just let her go out in the street. As I was driving out of the hospital, I saw her walking up and down and doing crazy things, and a police car came along and arrested her. So where was she going to be? The new place for them is not the mental hospital, but it's the closing mental hospital. The new mental place is going to be jail for them. I agree with the guy on the phone who's saying that what they did in New York, because they should be allowed to give them the medication, not just release them from the hospital when they're so sick.
And Maria, let me ask you one follow-up question. What is your biggest concern with your son, and what would you be like to be able to do?
My biggest concern is that he was sick again, and he was taken to an ER, a regular ER, to Crozier Chester. And while he was there, he was thrown out by the doctor, an MD, who said he's not suicidal. He kept saying he was suicidal. They had taken him there because he had the flu. After 10 hours of waiting, he had become a little bit psychotic. She said, he's not suicidal. Throw him out. And two security guards grabbed him and threw him in the street. That is my concern, because that's what brings violence from the mentally ill. My son is not violent. He's a nice person, and he's not a violent. Most mentally ill people are not violent, like Joe Roger is saying. It's just the system treat them so bad. The police have to have training how to treat the mentally ill, and even hospitals.
Yeah.
Because they release them in the street again.
All right.
And they just throw them out. Thank you for my opinion.
Yeah, Maria, thank you so much for calling us. And if you want to join the conversation, please call us at 1-888-477-9499. Mark, let me start with you and let you react to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Maria, all three of us would agree with you that things are not perfect in the mental health system. We have a lot of work to do, both inpatient, especially for people in crisis. Absolutely agree with that. One thing I'd also like to say, and I don't know how familiar you are with the whole range of services that might be available, but there are psychiatric rehabilitation services that could be offered and funded more. These are programs that support people in going back to work, going to school, dating, parenting, participate in religious communities, leisure recreation activities. These are the kinds of services, too, that have been primarily cut in states across the country that can be helpful and promote sense of self-worth, self-esteem, greater engagement. The one thing that I think we all agree on, too, is if we provide mental health services that people want, that meet their needs and goals, that will bring people in the mental health system. And right now, there are people who aren't coming because
I'm very sympathetic to what the caller is talking about. As a person with a diagnosis, I've experienced that. I've been in an emergency room, and I've had medical doctors with little training in psychiatry come and ignore my situation and just set me back out in the street. And I was actually quite suicidal. So I know that that happens, and that's why we need to have programs that really respond, crisis programs, crisis respite care. One very successful program that we have is crisis respite care run by peers, run by peer supporters, having a great success working particularly with young, very resistant individuals like the person that was described. So I think there's a lot of models that we have out there where we can help people. We just need the funding for those programs.
And Brian, what's your take?
Well, I want to thank Maria for calling. I think what she had to say really speaks more compellingly to everything that's wrong with the mental health system today than I ever could. And I think what we hear in her story is the consequence of taking this deference to self-determination too far and the cruel effects of that. You know, it's a policy that's maybe rooted in compassion and caring for people, but the consequences when we apply it in every case are that some people are going to be treated despicably and miserably, and we should be ashamed of the fact that we're turning people out in that condition. Self-determination for those who can use it, who are equipped to make their own decisions, is terrific, and I'm absolutely applauding everything that Mark and Joe are doing for people who are in that situation, who actually can understand they have an illness that needs to be treated. But I think what we heard in the call was the fact that there are some folks out there who do not want to be in a hospital, do not want to be treated even as an outpatient because they do not believe there is anything wrong with them. And the compassionate, kind thing to do for those folks is to give them treatment that they don't want.
And
that you know, maybe an unpleasant reality, but it's life.
Joe, I want to get to the heart of what you fear with outpatient commitment laws. I'm here at the station as a mental health reporter. I get calls from families who say, look, my son, my daughter is very ill. I cannot get them into treatment, and I'm desperately afraid they will hurt themselves.
In Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. we have an outpatient commitment statute on the book. Kendra's Law would kind of go and add some service components that we don't have, spell out kind of services that would exist. So we do have outpatient.
Right.
We have inpatient. We have involuntary treatment. We involuntary treat, in Philadelphia alone, thousands of people. On an annual basis, they're involuntarily committed. Unfortunately, we are under a system of managed care where things like you go to the hospital and you spend 3 days in the hospital and all of a sudden you're well. And because of the managed care decision that you don't medically it's not medically necessary anymore for you to get treatment, you find yourself on your street. So I think we're in agreement, all of us are in agreement, that it's horrendous the way people are getting treated with serious mental health issues. My fear of outpatient commitment is just increasing the amount of coercion and force. And that just drives people away. One reason people don't want to get involved in the mental health system is they're afraid they're going to get forced, they're going to get force medicated, they are going to be held down and injected. That does happen. It happened to me. I was held down by four very big people, and they had to be very big to hold me down, and I was forcibly injected. And that experience alone made me very fearful about going to get help. And I ended up homeless in the city of New York because of those kind of experiences where I wouldn't go and get help. It took somebody doing an outreach program, gently reaching out to me, working with me to convince me that there is help that's not going to be forced to get me back into help.
Yeah, and Joseph, I was actually one of those psych techs. I worked for a year on a locked inpatient acute unit with these folks coming in, and I used to have to hold people down and be there while injections were made. So from a provider perspective, I'm just as traumatized by this. This is not the way that I learned how to provide good clinical care. Coercion is not a part of the message that I got in my clinical training. My biggest concern, and Mike and I think it's a great question, what is my fear? My fear is the focus is on coercion as an approach to enhance adherence and engagement rather than promoting self-determination, choice, opportunity, providing services that people want in a way that they want it. And I think that that should be the primary focus. And maybe there's a little place. Well, I mean, Joseph's pointed out, we already have involuntary outpatient commitment, but the primary focus should be on choice, self-determination, services people want, and people want employment. People want to date. People want to be good parents. People want a house to live in. That they like. These are the things that have an impact on their mental health. The lack of these things are leading to the hospitalizations, the crises, all the things that are the person from TAC is talking about. These are the things. These are my fears. And there's another way to do it, a better way to do it.
Okay, Brian, I want to close out kind of this section about the legislative
sure.
efforts, but do you have any finishing thoughts on that?
Yes, please. First of all, let me point out that while you do have a law in Pennsylvania that allows both inpatient and outpatient commitment, it's extremely hard to use, particularly on the outpatient side, and as a result, it's very rarely used. The fact is the law requires that proof that the person is going to suffer serious bodily injury or death within the next 30 days unless this treatment is offered. And that's often a very difficult thing to prove, and it really shouldn't have to come to to the point where a person's on death's door before you can get them the help that they need. I just would also like to say this about this point about coercion. An interesting thing about the New York program that was studied is that the researchers who studied this from Duke University Medical School actually asked the patients who were part of this program whether they felt coerced and stigmatized. It turned out that whether a person was in an AOT program, an assisted outpatient treatment program, had no effect on whether they felt coerced or stigmatized by the mental health system. What tended to predict that people feeling that way was how respectfully they were treated by the folks they interacted with in that mental health system. And if they were treated respectfully, they didn't feel coerced whether they were under AOT or not. So this is really a red herring.
Mark, let me ask you, you worked in an ER-type setting. What kind of training do people have? If somebody comes into an ER with an acute mental illness crisis, what do people know about that?
So the training of the people who work. So I worked on a locked inpatient
yes.
acute unit. I had my bachelor's degree at the time and really didn't learn too much about how to deal with crisis in my undergraduate education. No fault of the undergraduate education. It's just, they don't teach you how to deal with crisis.
Right.
I would certainly say that the nursing staff and the medical staff were as respectful as we could be. And I would actually say that in the incidents that I was involved in, most of these cases, what happened, the person was a danger to themselves or others. But it was traumatizing. This is not the first approach. And I must say that on the unit that I worked on, we did everything we could. And this is really my take on AOT or involuntary outpatient commitment. We did everything we could to avoid this from happening. We threw as many resources. We talked. We worked with the person. This was a last resort. There was another unit in the same hospital where that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. We went to coercion first. We were secluding. I was called down. I was on the fifth floor. This other unit was on the second floor. I would be called down constantly for seclusions and restraints and sometimes injections because a patient called a nurse a bad name. And we would be down there and seclude this person. This is my fear that coercion can lead to, that these kinds of approaches, as the first approach, can really lead to. My heart goes out to the caller. I'm a family member as well. I've got concerns about people being in crisis and what you do, but we really have to balance these kinds of issues.
And we're coming up on another break here on Radio Time, so Joe, I'll let you react. When we come back, we're with Mark Zalzer from Temple University, Joe Rogers from the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania, and also joined by Brian Stetton from the Treatment Advocacy Center. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499, and we'll get back to the phones here on Radio Times right after our break.
The National Museum of American Jewish History supports WHYY and presents Beyond Race, Beyond Faith, a musical evening with intercultural journeys, Wednesday, January 30th at 7. Diverse cultures through world-class performances featuring acclaimed cellist and intercultural journeys founder Udi Bar-David, master storyteller and singer Charlotte Blake Alston, soprano virtuoso and executive director of Art Sanctuary Valerie Gay, and Freedom Theater actor and dancer Khalil Munir. 215-923-3811 or nmajh.org.
Because of my unfortunate situation with Avery, I'm alone. And I know, of course, that you're not seeing anyone. Therefore, I've decided that you and I should become friends with benefits.
No, thank you, please.
The final episode of 30 Rock airs next week. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews with Tina Fey, Alec Baldwin, and Tracy Morgan. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What's the future of the only clinic in Mississippi that performs abortions? Will new state regulations shut it down? Also, remembering the late poet Jack McCarthy, he took his daughter to see a poetry slam and then he got hooked. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about access to mental health care and the intersection between public safety and mental illness. Our guests are Mark Zalzer from Temple University. We have Joe Rogers from the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania and also Brian Stetton from the Treatment Advocacy Center. Joe, before our break, we were talking a bit about the ER setting and the hospital setting where oftentimes people with mental illness are brought into. And one of the issues is training. We've heard a lot about police officers being trained in terms of better reacting to people who are in mental illness crisis. What about other professions who should get this training? Are they getting it?
Well, a lot of the people that are interfacing in our public mental health system don't have enough training, don't understand mental illness that much. That's one of the reasons we've really supported the idea of peer-to-peer programming, because who better than somebody in recovery from a serious mental illness to have a real understanding of what the person's going through? And we have peers in Pennsylvania working on throughout the system. They work inpatient, they work outpatient, and we find that very effective. And the peers are very good trainers of the professionals, and so they have a greater understanding. You mentioned briefly the police. I just want to say that we've had a lot of success in training the police here. We developed it took us several years to get the police department to accept it, but we now have a crisis intervention team approach here in Philadelphia, and it has a huge impact on helping having the police understand what people with mental health issues are facing and being more effective in dealing with people with mental illness.
And Brian, let me turn to you. What do you think are the biggest gaps in terms of access to care? That has been another issue that has really come up a lot. We've talked a bit earlier about budget cuts that have really affected mental health services. So what's your thinking on that?
Well, absolutely, that's true. And one of the areas that has been cut the most to the greatest ill effect is the availability of psychiatric inpatient hospital beds. This is a piece of the system that has been eviscerated, very often with sort of a feel-good, happy message that Joe and Mark have probably supported about how this is great. We're transitioning to community care. And again, that's wonderful for people who are in a position to use community care. But there are also individuals who need to be in a hospital for weeks and sometimes months, and those beds are not available to them. And so part of the problem, it's not just the law, but another part of the problem is that people in the mental health system are forced to triage when someone comes who may actually even meet a state's commitment standard. If there's not a bed available to put that person in, they're going to go back out.
And Mark, let me turn to Mark Zalzer, because you have said in the past that it's not about, the fact that there's no hospital beds available, but that a lot of times community treatment has not been as available as it should have been.
Well, I mean, I'll try to not talk about the doom and gloom message that some people give if we give the happy and positive message, which I like to give. But I would say, first of all, that we're talking about episodic illnesses. These are episodic illnesses. And I think what our individual on the phone keeps talking about, and when we talk about crisis, this crisis for people with serious mental illnesses, this is 1 or 2% of their experience of the illness and of their lives, maybe even less than that. Very little amount of time. Thank goodness. And it's great that there are organizations out there, and I'm out there supporting, you know, the need to do something about crisis services and do we have enough beds or don't we have enough beds. But we have to all keep in mind that this is a small percentage of the experience that these individuals have. Most of the experience is living lives of quiet desperation. People don't have the supports, people don't have the services, people don't have the resources that would support them to hopefully keep them out of crisis in the future, keep them out of the hospital. So I'm not really disagreeing with the Treatment Advocacy Center. I'm more saying we need to focus on community services. And we do have gaps in psychiatric rehabilitation services. We do have long waiting lists. One of the things I liked about the Biden report, the Now is the Time report, is the real focus on services for transition age youth. Those are individuals aged 16 to 25. You go into the community mental health system, there are not services for these individuals, especially when they become adults, 18, I'd say 18 to 30. Those people are not present too much in community mental health centers, and those people avoid the system like the plague. And that's one thing that leads us to trouble. So we need more programs, like the Mental Health Association has a program in Montgomery County that supports transition age youth with peer support. These are the kinds of innovative programs that we really need. More of these community mental health services so we don't have to get to the kind of crises that Maria was talking about. These will happen, but we'll reduce them, hopefully. And we won't even have to talk about AOT or IOT.
The speaker from the phone is not from Philadelphia. And actually, in Philadelphia, we have a lot of psychiatric beds. A system that has a lot of psychiatric hospitals, a lot of psychiatric inpatient units. So we're not, you know, you don't have to wait too long if you're involuntarily committed to get a bed. We do involuntarily commit lots of people in Philadelphia. I think the problem is after you've been hospitalized, what happens? The continuity of care, particularly for young people. The head of our Department of Mental Health, Dr. Arthur Evans, just wrote an editorial op-ed piece a few weeks ago, particularly for young people in transition who don't have a diagnosis yet of serious and persistent mental illness because maybe it was their first hospitalization. There's not services available, so they end up coming out of the hospital and not getting the supports. And if they don't get the supports, they end up getting sick again.
All right, let's take another call. We have Nina joining us from Reading. Hi, Nina. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
The comment that I wanted to make is my son is 31 years old, and he suffers with chronic paranoid schizophrenia for 6 years now. And to Mr. Rogers, unfortunately, you know, we have been members of NAMI for 6 years, and no one prepares you for this what happens to you. And it was actually January 23rd, 1 year ago, when the voices became overwhelming, and my son woke up, and his intention was to kill himself and every single one of us. And my mother was the first victim. And it's really hard because he's not a violent person. He has always threatened before. There were people that came out to the house, and they even ran from the house because these were social workers with Sam because they were afraid. And we've had 302s that were declined, and it all had to do with medicine because he was very angry. He was tortured by the voices, and we listened to it every day. And then finally, it wasn't until he ended up in prison. And they didn't force him to take medicine, but it was when he was transported to the state hospital. They did not give him a choice, but they gave him a choice of Zyprexa or Risperdal. He chose Risperdal. And then he said to me, "You know what, Mom, I was wrong. I should have taken the medicine because I'm not angry anymore and I don't have the racing thoughts." And this is what upsets me, because 6 years of his life, and still no one has addressed his childhood trauma of what he has endured year after year within the school system.
All right, Nina, I'm so sorry. I want to. We're coming up toward the end of the show, so I do want to give our experts a chance to react, and I want to thank you for sharing your story. And Mark, my first question is, what kind of resources should be available for family members like Nina? Because as she said, you cannot be prepared for a journey like that, and you need others to help guide you, and you need somebody to help you.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Nina, my apologies, my sincere regards to you and your family and your son. For everything that you've gone through over the years. I think it's wonderful that Nina and many other people are using resources like NAMI, but there are other family resources that are out there, especially in Philadelphia County, with Family Resource Network and some other services that the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania has. Edie Mannion is somebody who runs a number of groups over there that are terrific supports. We certainly don't have enough supports for families, especially in some of the other counties in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. We need more family resources, family support, more psychoeducation, more information for families like Nina's. These are terrible situations, and unfortunately, aren't any clear answers.
And Joe, I guess one aspect here is also a sense of isolation that families often experience because they don't know who they can talk to about this. They don't talk about it. So families end up being very lonely in this journey.
Mental health issues, the kind of things that situation that was described, being isolated, being alone, the person feels isolated, the family feels isolated. That's why we're struggling so hard to make sure that there's self-help and mutual support programs, that there's peer-to-peer programs, there's comp-peer programs, that there are places for people to go to get the help, to be able to talk to somebody. And we hope that people get that message from this, that there is hope, there is help.
And what is the power, real quick, what is the power of peer programs?
Well, what we found for situations like was described, that sometimes if that person that does the outreach to the home is somebody who's been there before, who's gone through the similar struggles themselves, they can reach out to the person and get them to understand that, there's some help available, that maybe some medication on a temporary basis or even a more permanent basis can be helpful. I'm on Risperdal, and that's helped me. So I could talk to somebody about, well, have you thought about that you're angry all the time? And what can we do to help you deal with your anger? And there's alternatives to medication that help people deal with their anger. And so having those available, having somebody who's had that personal lived experience can make a big difference.
Mark, let me give you a chance to react.
Yeah, I was also going to say in response to Nina and her son, we didn't get to find out why it took so long to find services or to identify a problem. And this is one of my concerns about linking violence to mental illnesses. The doom and gloom narrative about mental health is that will drive people away. I've talked to many people, many patients with mental illnesses. They don't want that self-stigma label. They don't want to, they know everybody thinks they're wacko, crazy, violent, whatever. That's why they avoid the mental health system. That's why they don't want to take medications. And this is why we need to break away from that narrative, or at least expand the narrative and add some of the other stories that are out there.
And Brian, do you feel, what's your take? Everybody's been calling this doom and gloom. So what is your organization's message, and how do you feel about being positive versus being negative?
Well, I think it's absolutely a positive message that I'm giving, and this is really about following the golden rule. It's about treating people the way we would hope to be treated if we were in that situation. And I think Nina's call really speaks to that very powerfully. Her son was involuntarily medicated. At the time that happened, he wasn't going to accept medication on a voluntary basis. When he regained some insight, when he got to the other side, he told her that he was very glad that happened and wished that it happened sooner. And it's a horrible tragedy that 6 years of his life were taken. And so to me, the positive message here is that treatment works. Recovery is possible. But sometimes it requires us to intervene on behalf of a person who can't do that for themselves.
And Mark, what are some other problems with the mental health system? We've talked a lot about access. We've talked about funding. But there are also sometimes it seems a lot of services are duplicated, or the one hand doesn't know what the other one is doing, or there are different organizations all doing the same thing in different parcels of the country. So what do you feel are some of the other downfalls?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me say that I certainly agree with Brian that treatment certainly can work and can promote recovery and community inclusion for people. I also want to say that the mental health system has many strengths. There are many good agencies, many good programs out there. There are fragmented services. There are agencies that aren't communicating with each other, that can't, you know, don't share information as well. There are gaps in services. There are some services available in some agencies that aren't available in others. For me, a major gap, a major weakness is the lack of supports, psychiatric rehabilitation services.
What would that look like? We've been mentioning
that. So a psychiatric rehabilitation service, there's a program, an evidence-based practice called supported employment. We know that people with mental illnesses would, could, and should work. That this is a good thing that promotes mental health and recovery. The types of supports are helping somebody identify the type of job they want, help them get the job, and keep the job. It's working with them out in the community. These are competitive jobs, from, you know, working in restaurants to being an executive somewhere. This would be supported employment. Supported education, one of the major things that I hear from people is they're devastated if they have a first episode in college. Freshman year, these are their hopes, dreams, and desires are all based on getting a college education. They have a psychotic episode. They leave college for whatever reason, and it's hard to get back in, and they don't have the supports to stay in. These are critical services for us to be able to provide. This promotes long-term careers. So there are programs. There's supported education, which is an evidence-based program. So there are those kinds of gaps. I don't want to damn the whole system, but we have some gaps. There need to be more resources. And if there's a silver lining in all of this, it's that hopefully we're paying more attention to it. I just don't like it being on the back of gun violence, which is very cynical.
And we have to almost end. Joe, are you hopeful that more funding, a lot of services were cut in Pennsylvania and other states? Are you hopeful that some of that money might come back?
I think we've got to speak up. I think the family members that were on the phone, the people that are recipients of services, we have to be organized. We have to take it to the streets almost and say, we need these services and we need them now. And we need to make sure the governor understands that he can't cut our budgets.
All right. Thank you, Joe Rogers from the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania, also Mark Salzer, chair of the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple University. And joining us on the phone was Brian Stetton from the Treatment Advocacy Center. Thank you so much for being here. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Our engineer has been Kevin Griffin. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for listening.